This is Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Suzanne Hogan. Good morning. No culture is completely successful or satisfied with its synthesis or reconciliation between passionate love, comfort love, and sexual desire. That's from our guest, William Jankovic, who's done extensive research on love and sex across cultures, conducting field work from brothels to senior citizens' homes. He studied arranged marriage culture, courtship culture, polyamory, and monogamy. His research includes cultures from all around the world, including peoples in Papua New Guinea, Native American tribes, various Chinese dynasties, and the modern globalized world. Joining us now from KNPR in Nevada, William Jankovic. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. William Jankovic is an anthropologist and ethnic studies professor from the University of Nevada. He's editor of the books Romantic Passion, A Universal Experience, and Intimacies, Love and Sex Across Culture. Thanks for being with us.
Sure. Glad to be here.
So let's start by describing the different kinds of love. Can you just give us a basic definition to get started here?
Sure. These are really approximations that we use just to categorize a range of emotional feelings we feel. To start off, you would just say, what is romantic love or passionate love? And it has three properties. You're idealizing someone, it's an erotic context, and there's an assumption it's going to last for some time, maybe not forever. But it's not what you would deem a quickie. You plan to see the person. Now, idealizing could be a parent-child love. And you obviously think a child from a child's point of view that it's going to last forever. But it's never a really an erotic idealization. With people who are not kin, the love has an erotic component. But it also has an idealizing component where you really kind of emerged the old folk song of two becoming one. I think that is indeed what's happening, even though people might not be conscious of it. The problem with it, or not a problem, but running alongside this is another type of love, which some people call comfort or companionship love. The problem with that definition is that it suggests there's no passion at all, that you've just lapsed into a kind of a familiarity of just being comfortable together. And I think that's a really interesting and an important quality and really an admirable quality. If you think of how many people you're not comfortable with, probably most of the people you know you're not all that comfortable with. And therefore, to be comfortable with somebody, to feel just warm when you see them, is a wonderful achievement in a way. But however, this sense of it does still have an element of passion.
I'm wondering if you could tell us some of the physical impacts that humans feel when we experience romantic or passionate love.
Well, when I first started doing the research on this in the late 1980s, early 1990s, we had no good research on the brain in terms of how it applied to love. There was research on the brain, but nothing on this. And the hormonal elements of this was not understood very much at all. Since then, we've had a lot of independent researchers that have discovered some really interesting things. For example, we do know now that when people are in romantic love, they secrete a thing called serotonin, which is this intense high. It's really very similar to what you are on cocaine. So when we talk about like a drug, there is an element of drug. Now, this is an organic drug, and it has no harmful side effects, so to speak. But indeed, it really apps as an intense focusing. And remember, if romantic passion's idealization, you need an intense focusing. And what better way than to have the body help you? So, and what's remarkable about this is the serotonin process can be set off consciously or unconsciously. So our notion of love is blind or love at first sight, which doesn't happen as often as folklore would have it. But nonetheless, it does happen on occasion. And what you have going on here, I would suspect, is this emotional hormonal rush that floods the brain. And then you make a cognitive statement. You say, what's going on with me? Oh, my goodness, I must be in love.
Yeah,
now, comfort love.
Go on,
sure,
go
please,
ahead.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, Oxytocin. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, the cuddle hormone, because that seems to really confuse things for people, the feelings
Well, oxytocin really comes out of research with the prairie vole, which is, you know, this animal looks a bit like a prairie dog. And they've discovered, and they do pair bonding for life. And they found that when the two prairie voles together, they measured hormonal levels, and they've seen a spike in oxytocin, which has sometimes been told the cuddle love. Now, we thought maybe oxytocin was just something unique to other lower form of mammals, but we find humans also have it as well. And what that means is that when you're with somebody, you begin and you're touching them and you're snuggling. Look how much snuggling is part of the romantic dimension. You're setting off possibly an oxytocin release. We do know that male females, take nursing, mothers who nurse start secreting oxytocin within 10 minutes of nursing. And you can think of the adaptive benefits of why that would be so. In nursing, often as a baby starts getting teething, it can be painful for a woman. But if she's secreting oxytocin, she's going to feel more comfortable. She's not going to want to push away the baby, which would be the normal response when it's giving pain, but even type of embrace it sooner. Now, we never really were sure if men had the same thing if they held a baby. And we found that men also secrete oxytocin. Their body transforms it. However, it's not 10 minutes. It's around 25, 30 minutes. But if a man holds an infant for 25, 30 minutes, they will also begin to have this coupling thing. So you see, the oxytocin has nothing to do with eroticism, but it has everything to do with a sense of couple bonding. By the way, since I'm bringing up sexuality, I should point out that prostitutes are very clear that after they have sex, they jump up out of the bed. And why do they do that? Because we know that if you've had sexual intercourse and you've had what I would call a good orgasm, and you lay coupled together, both the male and the female will begin to secrete oxytocin. So if you don't want this hormonal transformation in your body to take place, the common response would be what? To get up and break off any tie. But if you're a couple and you want to create a greater loving bond, what better way than spend the night together touching each other? Because in the morning, you'll feel even closer, and you won't quite even know why. But part of it is that your body now has secreted a hormonal oxytocin will make you feel just warm and cuddly.
This is Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Suzanne Hogan. We're talking to William Jankovic, an anthropology professor at the University of Nevada, editor of Romantic Love, A Universal Experience in Intimacies, Love and Sex Across Culture. Now, studying romantic love from an anthropological perspective is relatively new, and I was wondering if you could talk briefly about how it's grown to be studying the way that you're studying it now.
Well, very simply, for the longest time, the historians and sociologists dominated our view of human emotions. And we thought there was no human nature. All there was cultural nature. So if that's true, if all there is society and history, then you have to say that romantic love becomes the Western disease. That was our disease. Other cultures had sexuality. They were free. They were uninhibited. They could express themselves. Let's go to the Polynesian Islands. Imagine all the films and things of that nature and our imagination on that. And because these people were not encumbered by love and all that all went with it, they were just free to express themselves. We, on the other hand, suffered. We had love. We had guilt. We had responsibilities. This really came about because of a particular model that was popular for forever, and that is that we are socially constructed people. We are not natural. And what I did, along with a lot of evolutionary-oriented psychologists, was ask the question, clearly we are animals that learn. Clearly humans are learning much like any other animal about what to do and what not to do. And humans, particularly because they have the ability to symbolize, can be influenced by a host of stuff. That's absolutely true. But still, there is a residue, if you will, of human nature. There are human universals. And I, for one, started wondering when my informants in China, when they started talking about love, I began to wonder if this was recent or not. And so I started exploring whether or not that was. And to my surprise, and I must admit, terribly surprised, I discovered that China had some of the world's oldest love stories ever. And yet they had an arranged marriage society up until the 1980s. So I was wondering, how can a society that had arranged marriages up into the 1980s have the world's oldest love stories? And that started becoming a juxtaposition between society's responsibilities and the individual desires and needs. And that really started me focusing on other cultures to see if this was typical of them as well.
And you went into research this, and in Romantic Love, A Universal Experience, you proved that romantic, passionate love is not a Western-created phenomenon, and that this universality, it's everywhere. It spans across all humans. But I'm wondering, what criteria did you use to look at these different cultures and determine whether or not they reached the criteria?
Yeah, good question. Well, let me tell you a story. I called up my friend. We went to graduate school, Barry Hewlett. Terrific anthropologist. Him and his wife have worked forever with the Akha Pygmies in Central Africa. And this is a conversation I had in 1988. And I called him up and I said, Barry, do the Pygmies have romantic love? And he said, absolutely not. And I says, well, have you ever seen exceptions where somebody got so depressed that they just felt sad? And there was a long pause. And he says, I have found among the Akara hunters and gatherers in Central African forest, he says that when a woman breaks up with a man or separate, or, well, the man, it doesn't, that's our words, but a woman tells a man, I don't want to see you anymore. Get out of my life. Some of the men, not all, some of the men have been known to climb 100 feet into a tree, put a vine around their neck, and hang themselves. And I said, why? Why did they commit suicide? And Barry said, he loved her. One of the ways I documented the presence of romantic love around the world was love suicides. We're not the only culture that does love suicides. It's found in a remarkable number of societies.
What's some of the other criteria, too? Because it's not just that. You look at some other...
No, It's not just love suicides. We also looked at one was whether people or not had a word for love. We looked at folklore. Did they have stories of people coming together and bonding and breaking up? A common theme is the inability to achieve your love object. It runs from the Amazonian stories among the Yamamamo that were recently in the news. These are Amazonian tribal people. And if you look at the mythology, if you look at the stories, a lot of people tell stories of animals, but they're anthropomorphizing. That is, they're putting human characteristics into animals. And so you'll see the rabbit meets the squirrel, and the squirrel's parent says that you cannot meet the rat, you cannot be together because you're different people, you're different species, but they run away, and then they're chased by the wolf and killed. Okay, now, what does that mean? Okay, that really is a love story, but they're talking an animal. But until we started having schooling, many cultures associated the natural world and the human world as kind of intertwined. So stories in one really were representative of the other. And so I took that to be psychological projection. People were taking human values and telling stories through animals, which, by the way, is what we do in morning cartoon shows when children are watching Bugs Bunny or Daffy Duck or whatever or SpongeBob. It's just very natural. You have to put in values and feelings that make sense, but you put them in animal form. So anyways, I looked at folklore around the world, and I was really surprised and delighted, really, to find evidence of romantic love being there. I also looked at questions of love magic. Okay, did they have love magic in the sense of trying to get the person to love one another? Now this is very important. Not all these cultures valued love. Many cultures thought that people in love were mentally ill. My documentation was not whether people valued it. And in the vast number of cultures, love was not a reason for marriage. But I wasn't interested, was it a reason for marriage, or did they think it was a good thing or a bad thing? I wanted to know, was this human emotion universal? So I started looking at the exceptions and seeing where it popped up. Take, for example, the Fube. The Fube do not value. The Fube are a a tribal pastoral people, farming people now living in Mali in West Africa. They're really expanding a number of countries in West Africa. And they believe you should always control your emotions. They think it's bad form to express your emotions. But they're very suspicious of love. Why? Because if they see a man hanging around another woman's hut or house, and he's there constantly, they begin to suspect that this is just not an exchange relationship, but that he is really becoming emotionally bonded. Now, in our culture, we would say, isn't that cool? But in their culture, they would say, that's bad form. Okay, any feelings he has, he should keep it quiet. But here's the most remarkable thing. When culture tells you it's bad, when culture tells you good people don't behave this way, you still see people behaving that way. Mm-hmm. And the power of love is that. And why do people fear love in these cultures? Because love creates a dyadic union. One and one create two. But really, two people create one. You create a small group. And you can resist anybody when you create a small group. And so people always run away together, never alone. Together, and they're able to resist others. So families are frightened of love, because if their child, male or female, decides to link up, they can challenge not only family authority, but also family inheritance rights and other things. So they have a vested interest in trying to undermine this.
William, I want to jump in quick because we're almost out of time and there's so much more. I want to talk to you. But you've studied polyamory a lot, and I'm wondering how this plays into all this. Is this not some type of solution to this conflict and tension that exists between all these different types of love that all humans feel?
Polyandry is really interesting. It's one woman with many husbands. But what people don't realize, it's generally one woman with one man and all his brothers. That's the most common type in Nepal and Tibet. It's very rare around the world, and it generally is an adaptive response to limited land supplies. Polyandry is interesting, just like polygyny, because you have a favorite husband. Remember, the essence of love is a dyad. You can only love one person at a time. And the question then is what about cultures that have multiple spouses, that it's legitimate, it's fair, people think it's honorable, and people do it? Do you find people in love with more than one person at one time? And with polyandry, I found there were favorite husbands. With polygyny, I found there's a favorite wife. Again, so you see marriage, you have to make a distinction between marriage, which can be plural, many people, many spouses, but within that, the human drive to couple is universal. It's exclusive, it's emotionally exclusive, and for most people, it's sexually exclusive. And that's what makes us incredibly interesting as a species, which is a wonderful thing to have on Valentine's Day, isn't it?
Right. Well, I just have one final question for you. Your study proved that 91% of the cultures that you studied feel this romantic love, but so not every culture met the criteria, and I'm just wondering how that doesn't kind of disprove that some cultures just don't have it.
That's true. No, we don't know if they don't have it. The 91 was where I could prove definitely that it was present. The other 9% that were in the sample, there just wasn't a sufficient data. Anthropologists did not start studying emotions until the 1980s, and love was not studied at all until the 1990s and the 21st century. So the absence of those 9 cultures, or 9% or so, is really we can't say. That they didn't have it. All we can say is I could not find any data to support that it was present. I suspect it was, because 91% is universal enough.
William Jankovic, we have to go. I wish we had more time.
Sure.
Thank you so much for joining us on this Valentine's Day morning. If you want to hear a playlist or see a list, rather, of the playlist that we put together in the first segment of the show with Richard Alwyn of The Love Hangover, you can go to our website at kcur.org. Thanks, everyone, for all of your contributions. Tune in tomorrow for Central Standard Friday with Monroe Dodd. We'll talk about The Book Enemies, A History of the FBI. Happy Valentine's Day, everyone. Also, happy birthday to all the Valentine's birthdays, including my mom, Valley Hogan. I love you, Mom. I hope you're having a good morning. And I promise I got you more than just a shout-out on the air as a present. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton. Our executive producer is Bill Anderson. Our intern is Claire McInerney. Kim Noble is our announcer today. And our theme music is by Miles Bonney. Up to Date is next with The Weekend To-Do List and Teenage Rules for Love. I'm Suzanne Hogan, and this is Central Standard. Enjoy the day.